is midday, time on Radio 3 for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The trials and tribulations that most of us all go through in life pale into insignificance compared to the early days of Zdenka Fantlova, who was a survivor at Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, amongst many others. Zdenka spent the early years of the war in Terezin before being deported to Auschwitz and subsequently Bergen-Belsen. Terezin, or Theresienstadt as it was known, was a concentration camp on the Czech border, which the Nazis used as a sort of show camp for the outside world, encouraging music, drama, even sport. In her book, The Tin Ring, one reads about a life that is so terrible, but it is written about both with humour and with a strange kind of love, a love of life, a love of music. It's called, as I said, The Tin Ring. And there's a particular reason for that, isn't there, Zdenka?
Yes, because my boyfriend, when he went to being transported to Auschwitz, gave me a tin ring. He made it himself out of a piece of tin, engraved the date inside, which was 13th of June, 1942, at the time when Reinhard Heydrich, who was the boss of occupied Czechoslovakia, was murdered. And this ring, when he gave it to me, he said, that will protect you. And after the war, if we survive, I'll find you somewhere. And that ring for me became a symbol of love and hope. And I have salvaged it to the last day of my life in Bergen-Belsen through a lot of really life danger times when my life was hanging on a line because of that.
Yes, because if the SS had found that ring, that would have been that, wouldn't they? So
no,
the fact that you went through searches with it under your tongue...
That's right. And you had to make up your mind and put your life online and say, do I want to throw it away? I would lose ground under my feet, or keep it.
After all that you have been through, and after all the years that have passed, has anything enabled you to understand how something like this could happen? Or is it still unfathomable to you?
No, I try to explain it to myself and realize that the whole case of the Holocaust was not a natural disaster like earthquake in Haiti or floods in Pakistan, that it was done by people and that people don't change, and that it is a warning because it can happen again under different circumstances, different times and so on, because people don't change. And there is a inborn cruelty in people. And when the time comes right and all the circumstances are together, there is an earthquake.
You mentioned at the beginning your boyfriend Arno, who gave you the tin ring. And I think there's a very strong connection with him and the first piece of music.
Yes, it is. And that was Dvořák's Ninth Symphony from the New World. And he picked out few of the bars from the first movement. And that was his signature tune. Whenever he could come near me somewhere in the camp, he would whistle it. And so I knew he was around and tried to find him and get together. So it was our signature tune in the camps.
despite the potency of the tin ring in your life, Stenka, Arno didn't survive, did he?
No, but I found out straight after the war only, not before, because that would have killed me. The 1,000 young men chosen for this special transport were taken to Poland, and next day lined up and machine gunned. So he didn't have a chance.
We heard the first movement of Dvorak's Symphony No. 9 in E minor from the New World, with the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Karel Ančel. And of course, that's another connection with Terezín.
Very dramatic one, of course, because Karel Ančel and myself were actually working in the kitchen, mixing some ersatz, or what do you call it, a soup powder, in huge, huge containers. And we were standing next to each other and talking about Brahms and Dvořák, how they composed their national music and dances and so on, and how they admired each other and so on. So, you know, it doesn't matter where you are. You are what you are. You don't change. You behave normally in abnormal conditions, which is something quite different. But then, soon after, the whole artistic contingent in Terezín, the artists, the musicians, actors, producers, directors, and so on, conductors, were put in the cattle trucks and transported to Auschwitz. And I was in the same car with him. When we arrived, people were moved immediately towards a selection. He was with his wife, who was holding a little boy who was born, actually, in Terezín, about 1 year old. And when you came to the end, there was a man in boots and helmet and everything, white gloves, like directing traffic on some left, right, left, 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 and it went very quickly. His wife is the child. Left, he right. Whoever went left went straight into the gas chamber. Whoever went right had a chance. That's where I saw him last. 15 years passed, and this picture was in my mind. 15 years passed, I have emigrated to Australia, and 1957, after the Olympic Games, the Czech Philharmonic was visiting Japan and came to Australia. And of course, I went to the concert in Melbourne. And all of a sudden, from the back, comes an elderly gentleman, all white-haired, Karel Ančel. I got such a shock because I couldn't put these two pictures. My last time I saw him was at the selection, left, right, gas chambers and so on. And suddenly he's a conductor of Czech Philharmonic who is here visiting Australia, 12,000 miles away from home. I just couldn't take it. I got a hysterical attack. I was crying and had to leave because people were shutting me up and get out and so on. Until next day when I rang him and we got together and, of course, reminisced and so on and talked about everything else.
In retrospect, life in Terezín must have been, compared to the things you then encountered.
It was a paradise compared to what came after. We were allowed to perform theatre, music, arts. But of course, the Germans knew very well why. They knew we were sentenced to death. And they let us go on with the arts and use it for propaganda.
So that they could actually show the world that everything's fine.
And that's right. Mm. Look, Hitler has given the Jews a town to live. Look how they live. Mm. And the arts survived more than ever before.
And in fact, there were some wonderful pieces written and composers working there. There was this 21-year-old composer who we're going to hear next, Gidon Klein.
Yes. Well, he was also my friend and a terribly good-looking man. Hollywood would grab him if they had him. He was a brilliant pianist as well. And I had a very dramatic encounter with him. One night in the attic of one of the barracks, you know, it was a military town, actually, for the soldiers, so the barracks were very high, 5 stories. And the attic was established as a theater, with stage and wooden benches and so on. And I was part of the Czech theater. And one night when we left, after the performance, I was the last one to leave. And suddenly Gideon comes in, stops me and says, stay here, I'll play something for you. And on the stage was a grand piano, because there were concerts as well. And he sat down in the darkened auditorium and played Chopin's Etude C minor. For me only, yes. And you know, it was surreal. If you suddenly realized where you were and thought, my God, this man who is a virtuoso should play in Carnegie Hall with a full auditorium. And I'm sitting here alone, listening to him. It's only for me. And under what circumstances, this is not real. This is not real. And yet you realize that even, and maybe because of these circumstances, the art survives.
Gideon Klein, who played you that Chopin study in C minor, opus 25, number 12, played there, by the way, by Vladimir Ashkenazy, and wonderfully so, too.
Of course.
Gideon Klein, he had quite an individual style already. He was clearly going to be quite a significant composer, wasn't he?
Yes. I think he was mostly influenced by Janáček, also coming from that part of the country.
Yeah.
And luckily, I don't know if all of the scores were salvaged and kept by his sister, Lisa, who was again with me in the other camps. And she was much older. She was, I think, 10 years older than Gideon, but looked after him as a child and so brought him up. And she herself was a musician. And for her, it was a treasure, of course. And later on, after many years after the war, somebody in America got hold of the scores and it has been published. You know, it's such a tragedy when you think people like him and many others, how the world has been impoverished by them being killed.
In fact, he wrote this piece that we're about to hear, only a few days before he was deported to Auschwitz.
Hmm.
Part of a string trio. It's the slow movement.
Yes.
Thank you.
What I would like to say as an interesting point is we'll never know if these composers were actually inspired by the contemporary scene. And I have a feeling that not much. That they were drawing from the past and into the future and considered the time in the camp as a transition. Like children who were drawing pictures, never drew what they saw, only what they remembered, a snowman, an ice cream, school, and so on. So it must have been also the case with the composers, where they felt this is a transition time and were drawing from experiences in the past and the future.
That was the central slow movement to Gideon Klein's String Trio of 1944. Daniel Hope played the violin, and incidentally, he dedicated this CD to his grandmother, Anna Klein. Philip Dukes played the viola, and Paul Watkins the cello. It was a rather fortuitous moment, Zdenko Fantlova, when you decided, when you were quite young, to learn a song that you particularly loved and which brought you to English, in a sense, or helped to bring you to English.
It was my fate. You know, living in a small town in Czechoslovakia, pre-war, we didn't speak English. We didn't know anything. And after the occupation, all Jewish, of course, students were expelled from their school, including myself from the high school. And at that time, somebody came with a recording with songs from American musicals. And amongst them was You Are My Lucky Star. And I was so fascinated by it and absolutely overwhelmed by the voice and the language, which I didn't understand a word. I decided there and then I must learn the language. And I had no reason. So I went to Prague to attend 1 year English Institute, which was then financed, I think, by the British Council. I was so diligent. We had, you know, in those days, there was no tourist sort of time. We didn't see many foreign tourists. We had English teachers. Mr. Henchman was a real Englishman. And I was just so fascinated by it all. Learned the language in 1 year and didn't know that 5 years later, it will save my life.
You are my lucky star.
You Are My Lucky Star, a song by Nacio Herr Braun. Interesting that we never credit songwriters. We always say Brahms, Mozart, I think, but people who write great tunes often don't even get mentioned. So there you are, Nacio Herr Braun, here's your credit. And there on that performance we heard Gene Kelly and Debbie Reynolds. Now, that knowledge of English, explain, Zdenka Fantlova, how that came to save your life.
5 years later, the British Army came and liberated us in Bergen-Belsen, where there were 20,000 corpses already lying, scattered all over the place, and I was still breathing, not very far from death. I never believed that I could die. I was not a victim. I felt like an observer, and I felt what was going on around me had nothing to do with me. And I had such a strong will, I had to survive because of Arno and the ring. And here I was at the last throw, and here appears a member of the British Army talking to me, sending me back to the block to which I belonged. And I answered him in English as though it was my mother tongue, and I could talk to him and communicate. And that saved my life.
Yeah, because I think it's important to understand that the reason why him finding you and taking you out was so crucial was that you probably only had hours, days to live.
Yes.
And if you'd gone back to the block, which they were liberating in rotation, weren't they? And it took quite a long time.
Next day.
You wouldn't have lasted that long.
Not next morning. Not next morning. But I asked him, if he can't save me, if he can't take me out, it would be better to shoot me. But the language, you know, language is a communicator.
Well, let's go back to your native language, as it were, for Smetana.
Yes. When I was 10, my father took me to Prague to the National Theatre for the performance of the Bartlett Bride. And since then, I have been absolutely sold about it.
Thank you.
You know, every time I hear Dvořák Smetana, it confirms my national identity.
We heard the overture to Smetana's Departed Bride, played by the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Zdeněk Kosla. Now, Zdenka Fantlova, another childhood memory to do with your father singing armed with a broomstick.
Well, he served in the First World War, and his favorite piece was Radetzky March. And so whenever he heard it, he would grab a broom or something and would conducting and walking through the house and enjoying it. So he did. But of course, in the end, he was a victim of the times because he listened to BBC News, which was strictly forbidden, and a neighbor denounced him. He was arrested, and in the end, he died in Auschwitz, leaving me with one of his wisdoms. When he said, "When you die, all you will take with you into the grave is what you have given away to others while you were alive."
the Radetzky March by Johann Strauss the Elder, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Nikolaus Arnoncourt. I noticed, Zdenka, that quite correctly, gentlemen that wanted to make an impression on you have known that the way to your heart is through music.
Yes.
And that's true of this, isn't it?
Yes, very much. Well, that happened in Australia, where I was longing actually for Europe. You know, you're too far away. You feel the distance. Mm. And yes, he wanted to impress me and so on, put on a record. And it made my life afterwards. And the record was Mozart's 40th Symphony, the G minor, played by Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Bruno Walter. It was a record he had on a turntable, standing on a box with a little bit of hessian over it. And the music transported me so far back to Europe that I decided, yes, with this man, who himself came from Berlin, actually, and his uncle was a conductor of the Berlin Opera, there is a connection for me with him to Europe and to the culture and to the life that we knew. And I said yes.
So you married him?
Yes.
Charles Ehrlich. Well, we haven't got the Vienna Philharmonic, but we have got Bruno Walter here conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra.
Thank you.
The first movement of the Mozart Symphony No. 40 in G minor, the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bruno Walter. These were now happier times for you, Zdenka Fandlova. You were working as an actress, you were married in Australia. But I suppose that there's no way you can ever escape what you've witnessed. Did you have that famous kind of problem that anybody has had who've been through that you felt guilty even though you had survived?
No, I feel that this experience has enriched my life. It made me realize the fundamental values in life, what matters. And there are very few. It's life and it's personal relationships, human relationships. And apart from that, it's not very much. And so if I have things, I accept them. If I don't have, I don't need them. And, you know, even Charles Darwin, your man, has said that a lot of changes happen in nature and in human life. He who can accept the change and adjust to it, he'll go on. And those who can't, can't. And this is in your character.
Well, Zdenka Fandlova, thank you very much for this music that you've played us, which takes us on a rather terrible but also very redemptive journey.
Thank you.
Zdenka Fandlova was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, now, the London Jazz Festival's getting into its stride, and next week on Private Passions there'll be another chance to hear one of this year's stars, the award-winning American jazz trumpeter and composer Terence Blanchard, and he'll be discussing his personal musical favourites with Michael Barclay. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall.
Tolstoy, 100 years since his death, a Radio 3 Sunday feature finds his influence looms large in a small Gloucestershire village.
There isn't anywhere really that's like here. This is quite unique.
It seems to have a closeness, and there seems to be something spiritual here as well.
My mum can remember people coming with coach trips and looking at these strange people who lived in Whiteway.
He was a man who had, by the age of 50, written what are probably two of the greatest novels in world literature. And I think he was concerned about, what do I do with my life now?
Tolstoy in the Cotswolds, this week's Radio 3 Sunday feature, starting at 9:30.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock. Time for the news from Ian Skelly.
The British couple, Paul and Rachel Chandler, who were kidnapped by Somali pirates more than a year ago, have been released. They were handed over to local security officials and are being flown out of the country. The couple from Tunbridge Wells in Kent were abducted on their yacht in October last year while they were sailing towards Tanzania. Their captors had threatened to kill them unless they received a ransom of nearly £4.5 million. The BBC observed the terms of an injunction obtained by the Chandlers' family, which was intended to stop news organisations reporting their release until they were out of Somalia for their own safety. Relatives in the UK say they are overjoyed at the couple's release. Burma's pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has told the BBC that her first priority is listening to what the Burmese people have to say. In an interview, a day after being released from years of house arrest, she said she wasn't fearful of being detained again, even though she accepted it was a possibility. Earlier, Aung San Suu Kyi told supporters in Rangoon that freedom of speech was the basis of democracy. Services of remembrance are being held to honour those who've died in wars and conflicts during the past century. The Queen has attended the annual ceremony at the Cenotaph in Whitehall. Prince William joined British troops at a service in Camp Bastion in Afghanistan. In Coventry, special ceremonies are taking place throughout the day to commemorate the 70th anniversary of one of the most devastating bombing raids of the Second World War. The authorities in Lebanon have arrested the radical Muslim cleric Omar Bakri days after he was sentenced to life in prison on terrorism charges. Mr. Bakri, who lived in Britain for many years, is said to have been taken from his home in the northern city of Tripoli. The weather forecast, there'll be some rain over southern Scotland this afternoon, but showers in southern parts of England and Wales will clear. Elsewhere, it'll be mainly dry, with a few showers, particularly along the coasts of Wales, northwest England and Northern Ireland. Overnight, most places will be dry, cold and frosty. And after a foggy start in the morning, it'll be mostly dry and bright. But there will be showers in Scotland. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's now 2 minutes past one.
And time for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show. Today, to mark Remembrance Sunday, we're going to hear highlights from a concert given last week at St George's Church, Kemp Town, as part of the 2010 Brighton Early Music Festival. The theme of the concert is Rites of Remembrance, and the soloist is one of the most celebrated names in the early music world, Emma Kirkby. In her long career, of course, Emma has contributed huge amounts to our understanding of early music. Her voice, instantly recognisable, can be heard on literally hundreds of recordings. These days, though, she's also making her mark as a mentor for the next generation of up-and-coming musicians. And as patron of the Brighton Early Music Festival, she appears in this concert alongside one of the newest young orchestras on the scene, the International Baroque Players, whose fresh approach and enthusiasm I hope you'll enjoy as much as I did. And I'll be talking to some of the members later on. It's also nice to see a female conductor on the podium for a change, Deborah Roberts, who was co-artistic director of the festival and director of the chorus we'll hear today, certainly had her hands full. So a rather sombre tone in today's early music show, focusing on the way composers have honoured the dead in biblical stories and in classical mythology. And we begin with a contemporary of Monteverdi, Sigismondo d'India, whose vocal pieces are characterised by that very newest style of the late Renaissance, in which the words were the most important thing, and the music, often full of strange dissonances and harmonic surprises, followed the natural rhythms of speech, all of it making for a much more dramatic and expressive effect than anything that had gone on before. This cantata is based on the story of Tancredi, a Christian knight who meets a mysterious opponent outside the walls of Jerusalem. A battle ensues, and the piece begins after Tancredi has mortally wounded his foe, only to discover to his horror when lifting the visor that it's none other than his beloved Clorinda. So here's Emma Kirkby with the oboe player Jadron Duncan.
Nulla pave, all'alma sì,
Emma Kirkby and the oboe player Jadran Duncan with Amico Hai Vinto by Sigismondo d'India. Our next piece looks at death not in the context of battle, but as a result of lost love. Dido's Lament from Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas is surely one of the most famous of all the early music repertoire, and it demonstrates just how powerful the composer could be when it came to word setting. He gives us slow, descending lines of melody as the abandoned Dido prepares for her last grieving farewell to the world. Death is now a welcome guest, she sings to her lady-in-waiting.